This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust, and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Welcome to Baldly Go, the officially unofficial podcast for all of Star Trek. This week we're talking about Season 2, Episode 5, titled Charades. Aaron, what did you think of this episode?
I thought it was pretty good. Charades. It's super fun.
If you're fancy.
If you're fancy, if you want to play it with your pinky sticking out. This was one of these are secretly my favorite Star Trek episodes. You know, when I think back about my favorites, you know, there's like Inner Light and All of Our Tomorrows, or I forget the, yeah, you think about those, but like the ones that I really like are episodes like Data's Day. I think my favorite Star Trek novels, they're always like the ones where Data becomes a human.
And the ones that start with personal logs, not captain's logs.
Yeah. Personal, and we've been personal log heavy this season of Star Trek. I like it. It's just super fun to see Spock as a fully human, dealing with hormones and smells and tastes and touches, and the fact that it's all kind of like this Meet the Fockers type of situation, where you get this uncompromising, intimidating Vulcan couple that you have to meet. These are going to be your in-laws. I really like Amanda Grayson. I guess she's been in this in Star Trek Disco before because of Spock being in Disco. But I was unfamiliar with her work, and I thought she brought a lot of like warmth and affection to the role, which is also always a hallmark of that character. I really enjoyed it. It's not like a serious one. It's not got a lot of heavy canon events. You know, Pike's not warding off a future vision of his own death or whatnot. It's just a fun, low stakes episode of Star Trek. I'm not sure I agree with everything that like Spock does. I was kind of shocked that he pulled the Ross Geller, "We're on a break. I'm just gonna sprint the chapel's quarters and start the human fucking immediately," but you know, I guess
this whole T'Pring thing is on its way out. The writing's on the wall here.
We know where it goes. Yeah. And honestly, I think these episodes, for as much as I don't know that I've always enjoyed the horny teenage Spock episodes of Star Trek, them fleshing out him at T'Pring's character goes a lot of the way for me understanding why she would set him up for a death match against his best friend in the old series, because he is mishandling her and her whole situation and taking her for granted in a way that's just somewhat shocking to me. The disrespect.
Try and get back together, it's going to be like, "Oh, well, you know, I slept with Chapel, but we were on a break." She's going to ask, you know, "When did this happen?" He's going to say about 45 seconds after we decided
after
to go on
left.
Break.
I had a drink with Captain Pike, and then it was on.
And you got to wonder. And they're going to the death match.
You got to wonder, because I kind of liked T'Pring as they've conceived her in the show. And but you're right. Like, the writing's on the wall. We know where this relationship ends up eventually. And how much more of just like, you know, failed Vulcan relationship do we want to really get to? Although I gotta say, like, how much of like schoolboy and girl infatuation relationship between Chapel and Spock I want to see? Not a ton there either. So
yeah, I feel like they need at least one more episode to really sell the deathmatch stuff. There has to be an episode where
betrayal.
She finds out about this, and there's some real obvious reveal here. But hopefully there's not too much more. But I did enjoy this episode quite a bit too. I think I've been watching DS9. It's weird how sometimes these episodes just coincide with each other, because yesterday, literally, I watched the episode where Jadzia and Worf, you know, have their engagement stuff that they're doing. They're going to get married, and Worf has to go, you know, do his Klingon bachelor party. Uh-huh. And Jadzia has to impress Martok's wife, which is difficult. It's much like trying to impress Spock's mother, or sorry, T'Pring's mother here. There's a lot of similarities there. Feels like that's the gear they go to when they say, oh, people are going to get married. There are some real trials and tribulations with that. They did it with Rom and Leeta, too. Same thing.
Well, I mean, because I think they're touching on, like, you know, this is a real life thing. Anytime we have, like, cultural or racial mixing, you know, you're talking about intermarrying from people from different faiths, people from different races, the, like, how are the parents going to treat it? Like, maybe the kids are cool with it, but their parents are very traditional. And it's actually, I kept on thinking of like that in terms of like what this would be if like you directly translated to an Earth thing. It's like, what?
It's Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which feels a lot.
Some of this stuff like breaks down. Like if you had an interracial child and then like an alien disassembled it, it's like, well, the instructions are unclear. Here's your, you know. Uh-huh. He went on an away mission with a white woman, so we're returning him as that, as like some of that shit would be wildly problematic. But it's, you know, it's fun to kind of explore this in a very extreme form, like the fact that, like, you know, it's one thing that if you came from like different socioeconomic, cultural standards, racial background, different expectations, different experiences, now extrapolate that to a completely truly alien environment, and it's that much more extreme, like there where you're reading minds and having to pick up stuff that's literally burning your flesh and it shouldn't burn there. That's you get away with it, but like I said, it's fun. It's just really fun, and Ethan Peck is having a lot of fun, you know, stretching out his human legs. I was really surprised about how game like Anson Mount was, like some of the shit that he does in the backgrounds. You know, as him kind of being host is just really hilarious. Like when his dad asks for another crack at the Vulcan snack and he's just like on it. And then he's back in the background assembling this tray as things are getting increasingly tense. And he wheels it just as Spock is dropping the like truth bomb on T'Prell. And he just like veers off at the last minute with the tray in the background. It's just really and him doing the like thing nice. About like, oh, yeah, this human tradition of charades, the sacred thing that we have. It's he's for as good looking as this guy is, he's just really funny, and his like timing on things is on fucking point.
I think everybody is great here. I really like Chapel's stuff too, you know, with her archaeological medicine thing that she was going fellowship though she was going for. I think they did a pretty good job handling that too, you know. The Vulcans are very kind of up their own ass about stuff, you know, they're Vulcans. And she's not really able to hang with that in the way they want her to, but ultimately she's getting more experience. She's out there in the field doing the work. She doesn't need this fellowship.
I really like Chapel's character. She's very sympathetic. It's going to be wild rewatching the old series with this series in mind, because like Chapel was always played in the old series as this person that had the kind of like the schoolgirl crush on Spock, and Spock was just completely aloof and, you know, didn't understand it. And like it's going to come across as kind of cruel, I think, now when you rewatch it, because it's this Spock playing dumb to a spurned lover, I guess.
Like ignoring the advances of somebody he's already been with. It's really weird.
Just
unless he has like his memories wiped.
Gaslighting his shit out of Nurse Chapel.
Maybe they both go into some other anomaly and have their memories wiped, and now
could be. Like I said, there's
feelings, but
lots of Strange New Worlds left, I hope, because I just really am enjoying it. But yeah, her being able to like in your face that stuck up Vulcan Science Academy guy was very satisfying. As a human, you love seeing the insufferable. And let's put it, they're racist. These Vulcans, as depicted, are just the worst type of racist The worst type of prejudicial stereotype, you know, all humans smell funny and they're intellectually inferior and they're emotional children. And it's all a bunch of gross shit. And it's nice to see them, get called out for it, mm-hmm. get fucked over by it.
I'm with you. All right. Maybe we should get into the recap.
Yes. Set Phasers to Ad. We'll be right back. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
It's the 40th anniversary of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom this week. And while the movie might be old enough to belong in a museum, our podcast is brand new. So join us for a conversation on the third or fourth best Indiana Jones movie, depending on who you ask, this Wednesday.
And if retro adventure movies aren't your thing, well, maybe you'll enjoy a time warp in the form of a prequel with the theatrical release of Furiosa. Flashback with us to a time when Charlize Theron looked like Anna Taylor-Joy, and strap in for another epic George Miller action movie this Thursday on Bald Move Pulp.
And finally, we're wrapping up our 4-week coverage of the 1980 TV miniseries Shogun. Get the final verdict on Yabu, JB, Mariko, and the rest of the gang this Thursday on Bald Move Prestige.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Captain on Bridge, welcome back to Baldy Go.
Well, let's start off with one of the two personal logs. It's Christine Chappell's personal log. She talks about how they're going to Vulcan to survey one of the moons, Kirkov. Ancient civilization used to live there, but has vanished. But there's some strange energy signature. And Captain Pike is giving them some downtime by traveling very slowly to this moon.
Yeah. I felt like someone slapped me when I heard the name of this moon, because it sounds so much like my actual very unusual sounding last name that it just like really took me aback. Like this whole, every time they're like saying that I'm from this civilization, I'm like, this is a fucking trip.
Yeah, I wasn't going to bring it up. I was wondering if you were going to talk about it. Cause yeah, I was feeling the same. I was like, wait.
Yeah. It's what? Really, it's really funny. It's like, oh my God, I'm getting a Star Trek tribute. So we kind of expressed like, what the fuck is archaeological medicine? That seems kind of like a dodgy, weird concept. But the way they in the way they depict it in this, it kind of makes sense that if you got this Milky Way galaxy that's littered with advanced civilizations that have disappeared because they've been wiped out by a solar flare, they've ascended to a higher plane of existence, which they kind of imply in this episode, that would be a treasure trove. Like, why wouldn't you need archaeological engineers, and you'd probably want people, like, you know, because everyone's combing over for the technology, but like, what about advances in medical science and genetics and things like that? Like, it seems like it is a valid branch. I'm like, well, why would anyone dig up Vulcan shit to find out, like, don't Vulcans know their own history? Or but like, yeah,
this very Earth-centric, like, why would we go digging around in the dirt to try and find advanced medical practices? Well, we wouldn't,
right?
But on other planets, you know,
right,
crazy,
yeah,
like, stuff could exist.
Like, completely disappeared civilizations that, you know, had a technological superiority. And even if they didn't, they had different, you know, compounds and ways of thinking and that you could glean into. That made a lot of sense. So it's a cool future job.
How the Vulcans never checked out this moon?
It's in their system, right?
Of Vulcan. Yeah.
It's, well, so Vulcan canonically doesn't have moons. But it's in the their planetary system. And I actually tried to check this out. Of course, this is a case where I'm reviewing this from the future. This is an episode that hasn't been publicly released yet. So I went to go to look on Memory Alpha, and it seems like there's only been two named planets in the Vulcan system. Vulcan and some other one that I didn't recognize. Vulcan didn't have any moon, so I guess this is just some. And when they say Vulcan system, are they talking about like a solar type system, a star system, or are they talking like a Vulcan region of space?
Well, I assume it's the Vulcan star system, which,
yeah, I believe so too.
Yeah,
but it's, yeah, this ancient civilization. But you're right. Yeah, why
think within their star system they would be the ones to pinpoint the energy signature, and they would have done it a long time ago.
You'd think so.
Yeah, I mean, as far as spacefaring civilizations, they were at least light years ahead of us. But
it's not logical to take a joyride through the Vulcan asteroid belt, Jim. So they just never bothered to.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, we see Chapel prepping for her interview with the Archaeological Medicine Fellowship by studying, working out, drinking with her friends while answering quiz questions. The weird thing about this is she's not practicing with Spock, which would be the natural choice. And her friends all say, yeah, that's kind of weird. And she's like, yeah, it's kind of weird, but things are weird with us. And we'll see a lot more about that here in a bit. But let's go over to Spock's personal log. He's dealing with his stress issues by cooking with Captain Pike and taking emotional suppressants. Apparently, humans stink. Humans stink. What do you think humans smell like? That's what I want to know. Because there's a lot of different stinks, right? It's sulfur, there are onions that make your eyes water. Like,
they're thinking our body odor, like the scent that our sweat glands make, and particularly the bacteria that make when they feed upon our sweat, that's probably distinct.
They're just
to humans.
So sensitive to those scents that...
Or like the Vulcans, because they live on an arid, dry planet. They have much higher body temperatures than us. I don't think they sweat as easily. So the idea that, you know, they just... Because I think there's even cultures and climates where people naturally stink less. You know, you've got like... I think like if you go back in time before we had air conditioning and heating, if you go back to like, you know, any kind of culture that's in a very cold condition, that are not taking baths a lot, they probably stank a lot. And you got people to live in like hot climates and stuff. But I think that there's some you know, varieties of human that have less hair and are apt to sweat less, and they have a less than natural odor. But apparently with Vulcans, it's just like so overpowering.
Half of their mental energy is spent keeping their emotions in check, and half is spent not gagging at human stench.
Yeah. And I get, because like I've been around people, you know, I've been to Gen Con. I've been to Magic the Gathering tournaments. I've been to places where there's some acrid smells from my fellow humans. And it is a bit of an effort to like, you know, yeah, sure, I'll take three to the face there. It's a bit of effort to keep up the kind of the whatever you're doing. So I kind of have, but also like this, again, this is really... really small-minded of Vulcans, you know. Although I guess they're taking nasal suppressants.
Well, he's taking suppressants for his emotions, and I think they are in nasal form, right? Or no,
he specifically says nasal suppressants. He's fully suppressing his emotions and partially suppressing his nasals.
Is this a thing?
I don't think so.
Thing that he's doing throughout the entirety of his Enterprise stay?
I wonder if they'll ever make it a point that, like, I no longer am taking my nasal suppressants because I've gotten used to human stink. I don't know.
I'm surprised they didn't have a scene where he goes around smelling humans and is just, like, happy he can't smell them.
Well, I'm also like, is Sarek just, like, a true freak that he just, like, he's, like, all up in Amanda, like, oh, God, I love the waste. I mean, is he that way with it? Is Spock going to be that way with Chapel? Is he going to be rolling around in his quarters and be like, oh, God, I'm loving all this, but I got to re-up my nasal suppressants because, woo.
It's the opposite of every scene you see in movies where they smell the pillow after they leave.
Yeah.
He puts the pillow in the matter reclamation chamber.
He doesn't. It has a new one. Yeah.
I don't even think they have those yet, but. Yeah, you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do think it's, and then again, Pike is so funny in this scene where, you know, he's trying to, you know, like trying to teach Spock how to cook and then realize that he can't smell anything, not even like fresh ground basil or whatever. And I just like how much Pike likes cooking. It's funny.
Yeah. So Spock talks to T'Pring over comms here, and she says she wants to have their ceremonial engagement dinner. He agrees, but he's preoccupied with thoughts of the dinner during his other duties. I don't know if there's much to say about this. We'll get to the fun stuff with that.
It's funny in contrast to see the scene of like all the crew laughing and whatever their version of Tin Ford was called, and like everyone's just like losing their shit laughing, and they pan around to Spock and he's just sitting there with one eyebrow cocked. Mm-hmm. And also, like, when Pike observes him being distracted and he just deadpans this, you know, situation with my mother-in-law, is, as you humans say, a big deal. It's just, I don't know, man. It's a lot of Brent Spiner Data in some of this performance, and I ate it up.
Yeah, they're reminding us just how buttoned up he is, so that later in the episode, the contrast will be more apparent.
And it sure as hell is.
So Pike has Spock pilot the shuttle to the moon, and Nurse Chapel is going to go along. The shuttle ride is pretty awkward. Chapel tries to talk about it, but their mission distracts them, and they find that the energy signature is actually a rupture in space-time, which sucks them in, and Spock awakens to find out that he's now 100% fully human, including his messy hair. I don't understand the change in hair necessarily,
it's
but okay.
Very subtle. It's very subtle. Human hair just naturally more untamable than Vulcan. I don't know.
Yeah, the hair's got emotions too.
It does. It does. The crazed emotional state comes out through the hair follicles in humans.
Hmm.
I like the smash cut from, you know, him realizing what he, and he goes, "What the f?" And it just goes right to the credit sequence.
Yeah. Yeah,
classy.
Good stuff. Classier than Picard.
True. Hard to believe.
So, Una and Lon are investigating the shuttle that Spock and Chapel were on. Seems like everything's in perfect shape. No problems. There is, however, a device they left on board, which is an alien communication device. And Pike uses it to contact the aliens. They say, "We did you guys a solid. We fixed Spock's DNA by unmixing it." They took out the Vulcan part of his DNA.
Yeah, it's like, we found two people and they look like they're supposed to match, but one of them is 50% mixed up, so we unmixed them. We took all the Vulcan stuff out, I wonder, that's the thing. It's like some of this, like, genetics, like if you take 50% out of someone's genetic code and replace it with human DNA, and the only thing that's different about them is the rounded ears and slightly messier hair and slightly pinker skin. Mm-hmm. Like, really? It doesn't fuck with your facial structure, your bone structure, nothing else. It just looks just like Gregory Ethan Peck the whole time. Huh? Okay.
Seems like it.
Man, I love the way that these guys.
I thought there was a skin tone difference that there's. Should probably have happened, but I don't think they really did it.
No, he's definitely pinker. He's definitely they lay off the green bronze kind of thing on this episode. But it was never as pronounced as they got with like Leonard Nimoy in the old days.
Not even close.
But I don't know. I like the fact that this these aliens, these Krakovians, have like the manner of like they're the opposite of the people trying to always contact you about your car's warranty. It's like, hey, you know, we get it. There's a fender bender. We completely restored your vehicle and the occupants, and there's no need to contact us anymore. No need for thank you. Or it's like this weird isolationist, extra dimensional race that nevertheless realizes that every once in a while lesser beings are going to stumble into our highway and get hurt, and yeah, we probably should fix them, but I don't know.
Yeah, there are weird assumptions being made by these aliens about what's natural and what's not, and like it's like if you got in a fender bender in an SUV and they were like and you hit like a sedan, and they were like, well, your SUV got all fucked up because now it has truck parts on it, so we took the truck parts off and made it a car.
Right.
What?
Yeah.
What? They're making an awful lot of assumptions about humans being the standard default of life forms, especially when they themselves are nothing like the humans. I don't know.
That's reminded me of like, is it the Zokfot pick in Star Control 2? The beings that live in a gas cloud? And they all like they all give themselves names after colors and textures. Like this is yellow versus blue, but they all look the same. Because I thought I got a kick out of like yellow showing up in their blue, and then blue shows up in their blue. I don't know. The fact like how does the universal translator even work? We have some feedback about that, but how does the universal translator even work in these type of conditions? You know, like what. Yeah. What commonality do you have? But I guess at some point the Krakovians were unevolved beings, were corporeal beings.
Yeah, possibly.
Because they lived on a planet and they had this, like, they didn't die or they're not missing. They just ascended to an interdimensional plane. But I don't know. I love a truly strange alien.
Yeah, I do too. So let's get to the good parts of this episode. Spock is experiencing some human emotions. He's worried about this engagement dinner. Pike's trying to cover for him by telling T'Pring that he was in an accident and they postponed the dinner. And so he goes about his duties, enjoying his new human powers of emotion and smell. But I would say he goes a little too hard.
Classic Star Trek. You know, when you have this person with a change in state that just has wild shifts in her behavior. The fact that he, like, I love him just putting away so much bacon.
I mean, shit, I would do that if I didn't realize the consequence.
Right? Like, it's like, oh my God, it's crispy and soft and salty and savory and sweet. And it's just like, he just can't get enough bacon. He's just putting away so much bacon.
He's laughing at all the jokes, but... You know, a little too hard. It's like Data. It's a lot like Data getting his emotion chip activated.
That's a very good comparison. Yeah. And he's just too much. Like, he's laughing a little too hard. Like, he's with Lon and he's trying to, like, level with her. But then he becomes intensely aroused just by being around her. And she's like, whoa, you need to learn how to do impulse control. It's like horny teenage Spock because he's never been through a human puberty before. And
the rage that comes out. Okay, here's what I was thinking during these scenes. I'm like, all right, this is an opportunity for Spock to truly explore the nature of his feelings for Nurse Chapel, because he can now feel what I think are the same feelings he felt before, but he can actually acknowledge them and react to them, and he doesn't have to try and suppress them. And the same would apply, I guess, to his love for bacon and also his hatred of Sam Kirk.
What a slob he is.
He fucking hates this guy. Like, he's been biting his Vulcan tongue to the point of severing it over the course of these years he spent on the ship with that man.
When he screams, "Don't test me, Kirk, I will break,
I will break you.
Over his lack of bussing his own table. Oh my God, so funny.
Yeah, this guy's lucky he's a Vulcan, because if not, he would have been broken.
So I got a question. All my Star Trek fan life, I've heard from Vulcans that it's not that they don't have emotions. In fact, their emotions are so much stronger and deeper than humans. And that's why they've had to suppress them, because otherwise they turn into like Romulans, who are also not demonstrative people.
Right. They're just
I'm calling awful. A giant cap on all of Vulcan, because the second Spock gets human emotions, he's a fucking insane person. If like this should be even easier if he downgrades from Vulcan to fully human and like his intense Vulcan emotions aren't there. Like, it's got to be a lie, right? Like human, like this is a cope that Vulcans are on, that our emotions are just so fucking strong we have to ruthlessly control them, and you humans couldn't possibly, like, it's that's a whole bunch of bullshit. This episode is demonstrable proof.
Yeah, this feels like a collective mythology that the Vulcans have come up with to make themselves seem more badass than they actually are.
Yeah, a just so story to explain why they are uniquely qualified to be the best people in the galaxy, apparently.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I've seen episodes that are contrary to that, right? There have been times where Spock has had his emotions surface for various reasons where they are intensely powerful, at least as powerful.
Or like Sarek when he is losing his mind and like now he doesn't have any Vulcan control, and it's just so maybe there that's evidence to the contrary, but that's also a diseased Vulcan mind. So like,
well, he's also fully human here. I mean, we can't forget that he's not Vulcan anymore, right? So
right,
like
at all.
He's reacting to these emotions as a human would, and if we are weak, pathetic minded, emotionally driven people, then you know, we would react to these weaker versions of emotions with stronger reactions.
So I guess that's my question, is like, how much of Vulcan's control is physiological and how much, because I was just always a discipline, you know, and that's the one thing that kind of bothered me, is that like, it's almost like Spock forgot everything about being a Vulcan, you know, like the, like there's this one scene where the crew has to like explain to him how to talk and speak as a Vulcan. I'm like, wouldn't you just from a muscle member, like, do you not know how you talk? But like his whole brain's been restructured, so maybe not. I don't know. It's very science fiction fantasy type concept we're dealing with here. And it seems like they always rolled with whatever is funniest, you know, like we're just going to go with whatever's funniest. It doesn't matter if it doesn't strictly make sense. And that's honestly probably the call to make.
Yeah, it was fine. I don't have any huge problems with canon here. You mentioned the scene where Spock talks to Lon about his humanness. She tells him to work on his impulse control. I didn't think he's going to over the course of this episode. I was curious why he talks to Lon about this, though. Is this the person you want to be talking to about this? Not Mbenga, not like Pike, not anybody who's well within his sort of sphere of confidence?
It made sense to me because I feel like La'an is probably the closest in Vulcan temperament, you know. You know, like she seems to keep herself at a pretty high level of reserve and remove. So maybe, but I thought that was weird too. And the only thing I could think of is he saw her as simpatico in some way. That maybe Pike and Mbenga, and obviously can't talk about it with Chapel, would be.
It felt like just to give her something to do, honestly, because you're going to
be that too,
you know, Ortegas and her out on the shuttle with Chapel later.
Yeah.
No, Una and Lon felt very like background characters in this.
That makes a lot of sense too.
Chapel's having no luck on a cure for Spock. You know, whatever cure means in this scenario, turning it back into a Vulcan. She feels responsible for his condition. Got a lot of survivor's guilt here. And she forgets about her interview and then remembers and runs off to go to it.
Yes. I don't have anything else to add to that.
Okay, perfect. The Vulcan in charge of Chapel's interview is unimpressed with her application. And she tells him, well, look at my field work. I've got a huge body of field work. And he's like, interesting. And he signs off very abruptly. This guy seems like a real dick.
Yeah.
Like, even more so than a typical Vulcan. He feels vindictive in a way that Vulcans shouldn't. Like, they need to examine him. They need to look at his credentials and see whether he still deserves a position.
Yeah. It does seem like this seems very a theme that runs through Star Trek is that Vulcans have a kind of like the like at best Vulcans are bemused by human conduct, but like there's a strong distaste for and maybe some jealousy that like, you know, like Starfleet and the Federation was kind of like the Vulcans' idea, and it seems like humans just came and like, yeah, well, we're gonna run it now. And maybe there is some like feeling like they got surpassed by these upjump apes from the Earth has caused, especially the ones that are more traditional. It always seems like the more traditional Vulcans that have the biggest problems, but
it's a real superiority complex in those Vulcans.
But even he's like, you know, like it's a little much for me to think that like Vulcans are rewarded for rote memorization at this kind of like post-doctorate level. Like, you know, that like we don't want to hear you reformulating to see that you understand it. We want to hear our words regurgitated exactly back to us, and we only value this rote memorization, your field work and your your natural surmising and all that. We don't give a shit about that. Like, oh, I'll glance at that, and then hangs up on her. Yeah, you know, he's a as Spock says, Vulcans can be real dicks, or I forget exactly what he said. Did he say what did he say? Did he say they can be real dicks, or they can be real assholes? I feel like he said something very vulgar.
Probably, he's human.
Yeah, in the next scene with Chapel.
Yeah. He runs into her in the corridor and sees that she's worried. So he hugs her in like a real awkward but meaningful way. You know, he's trying his best as a new human. And I think Chapel's into it. Chapel's liking the slaps on the arm and the touchy feely nature and him making jokes, and she likes this about him, the new Spock.
She's definitely like Spock. It's weird because he took a lot of bro energy. You know, it very much felt like a guy who is just like, slapping her on her shoulder, giving her an awkward hug, like no acknowledgement that there is deeper feelings there.
Yeah, it's still very awkward between them. Yeah. Because there are those feelings, but.
But in a different, in a way that was different than what I guess I was expecting.
Gotcha.
But it's hard to say exactly what, because, you know, a bombshell's dropped on him, which is your mother has beamed aboard.
Everything's about to change. Spock's mom beams aboard, and he has to try and pretend to be Vulcan still by wearing some silly hat while she tries to convince him to go through with the engagement dinner. And she says it's going to be tomorrow night on the Enterprise, which is a real problem. Spock gets angry. He wants to cancel the dinner. He ends up showing his emotions, and his mom realizes he's human. Oops. And this is where I started to realize what this episode was going to be, and was like, okay, I'm into this. I like, if you're doing a, you know, sort of weird riff on Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, but with like a comedy bent, I'm into it. Let's see what you got, Star Trek.
So I really liked this version of Spock's mom. You know, I've seen, I think, 4 or 5 different versions at this point. You know, you had the original series, you had Spock's stepmom in The Next Generation. She obviously Winona Ryder in the J.J. Abrams reboots. I thought this was a pretty good one. Mia Kirshner, she's a Canadian actress that's done a bunch of different stuff. Would you care to guess how old she is? I'm going to do this all season long because it's never not blows my mind.
Well, I'm going to say 40 every time.
All right. She's 40 fucking 8 years old. 48 years old. She's 10 years older than Ethan Peck, who's playing now. And I'm wondering, like, do these ages actually match up? Because canonically, I think Spock is really like, he's like in his 60s.
Oh,
right.
Well, no, that doesn't make any sense.
I think so. Because Vulcans age very, very slowly.
So she'd be like 80 something.
Yeah,
and she's fully human, so it's she's not like she's human. Got slow aging Vulcan.
I mean, I think that like humans live a lot longer in especially in the Next Generation, because we saw like Dr. McCoy was like, I don't know, 140, 150 years old, but he was also looked ancient. He looked like old Yoda at 900 years old. So I don't know. They're doing like, I think this. I mean, I don't know what they're doing up in Canada that they are just staying so fucking youthful. But I thought it's shocking that she's 48, and I felt like it looked like she's the same age as Spock, and is not far off. But
cryopods. They also don't stink in Canada like most humans do.
True, true. It's all the maple syrup that counteracts the natural stink.
Sweet smell.
Rest of us have. Yeah. Clean living and maple syrup is how the Canadian and universal health care probably doesn't hurt either.
Yeah, I'm sure that helps. Pike and Spock and his mother all talk about the intricacies of this Vulcan wedding stuff. You have to apparently make the family's tea recipe, and his mother volunteers to teach him how to be human by lying, and they give him fake Vulcan ears. Teach him to talk.
Fucking funny.
It is so bad. The ears.
It's so funny to see Ethan Peck handed what are probably his actual prosthetic ears and like, har, we're going to make you up to look Vulcan. It's such a cheap trick, but it's so funny in context. I love it.
The stuff I love is giving the actor a chance to act poorly. Like he's trying, like during this mind meld stuff, he's trying to act like he knows what he's seeing here. Yeah. Even though he can't see it. And I think it's hilarious.
He's taking direction from other people and he just can't fucking do it. You know, he's trying to. And can we talk about him showing up in the space hat?
Oh, my God.
And his mom's like, what are you wearing that ridiculous hat for? It's like it's regulation. And Pike without missing a beat. Yeah, I've got one just like it. It's oh, my God. Oh, yeah.
I want to see Pike in that hat before the end of the season. It will be a failure if we don't.
Mr. Mount is doing some just world-class supporting acting work on the show that he stars in. I tell you what, he is one of the reasons so much of this stuff works, because he is just selling everything, and it's so, so funny. And Spock's facial muscles spasming as his mom keeps dropping on bad news, like, hey, we can't delay this dinner anymore. Her mom's getting cold feet. She's going to call off the whole thing. He's like, my facial muscles are spasming. It's from the wreck. It's really
nerve damage.
Yeah, it's really funny.
Yeah, good scenes here. There's apparently a Festivus style airing of grievances that's going to happen during this, and the fake mind meld that we kind of mentioned.
Yeah,
and those will all be
the awareness ritual. Yeah, parents, but Vulcan parents must love the awareness ritual where I'm just going to take 60 seconds to talk shit about you and tell you all of your flaws, you know, so you can improve.
Yeah, it's very Vulcan. Chapel's procedures aren't working because apparently Spock's condition is becoming permanent and they're running out of time. They only have a day to make the cure work. She decides desperately she's going to go ask the Kirkovians to change him back. And she recruits Ortegas and Uhura to pilot her back there.
I love the Trekno babble here. His cellular plasticity is starting to get rigid. Like he's a blob of resin that's starting to cure on the shelf. You know, it's like, you can only be flexible for another couple of hours. And then he's just going to turn into hard Vulcan resin. But whatever. It's
I guess so.
Also, like, I don't know. The other thing is, like, by the end of the episode, when they go back to the aliens, like, obviously there's no plasticity to unplastic for the aliens to fix, because I'm pretty sure Spock is pretty fucking calcified as half Vulcan, half human when he rolled into their rift. So
that's what I'm wondering. They give her a cure, but they don't just like magically change Spock back. They give her a solution that she injects that will turn him back.
Oh, that's true. That's so true. Like, they didn't have to. So they probably could have brought him into the body shop, but they gave her a medical advance. Good point. Yeah.
Yeah. If I'm Chapel, I'm at least saving a little bit of that to examine, so that if we ever need to go on an away mission where we all need to be Vulcans, we can like actually turn ourselves into Vulcans. We don't have to do the fake ears and shit like that.
Well, no,
plastic,
I think that's
surgery.
Well, the wild thing is like, I think that's what they would have done, because Mbinga says, like, we can't give you Vulcan ears genetically because it will interfere with the genetic therapy that Nurse Chapel's trying to do, so we're just going to glue on ears. But like, also, how many rules, how many Federation laws did they break altering Spock's DNA?
Oh, a ton.
But
I
is
mean,
there a loophole
about
that? Is there a loophole that, like, well, you're actually restoring him to his original condition?
I don't know. Star Trek is so conflicted on this, because many times I see away teams going on missions where they can't modify their internals, and they say, hey, if we get caught on scans, we'll be detected, but what we can do is plastic surgery.
Yeah,
to make like that look like oh, I'm gonna put ridges on my nose to look like a Bajoran or something like that,
right? Or like with that one thing
where
Riker landed on the planet and they did up his face, mm-hmm. but his organs, and like he's wearing gloves so his fingers don't look. Yeah, like it seems like Federation kind of half-asses some of these first contact.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe Crusher just isn't as good of a doctor as Mbenga is.
Yeah, if the red or blue won't fix whatever, she's like, I don't know. Go have the barber make the blue barber guy will cut your hair and make you up. Okay, that's the best I can offer.
Yeah, 100 years in the future, they've lost a lot of the knowledge they had because the red and blue basically solves everything for them.
True. True. That is the ultimate archaeological find.
Yeah, they're going to find that next season. The red and the blue. God, that'd be such a good... such a good cut. They don't even have to... Don't be explicit about it, not be like, this is the red and this is the blue, but like, over the course of a season, just have them find these archaeological medicine things.
And then there's just giant 6-gallon jar of both, and Mbenga's sick bay just shows up. Yeah. Yeah, I would love that.
Red alert. Here comes an ad break.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Let's boldly go back to the episode. Welcome back to Baldly Go. Boy, where were we here? Oh yeah, the shuttle. So we just talked about how Ortegas and Uhura are going to pilot her back to the anomaly. And then we go back to Spock, who's nervous about the dinner party.
But wait a second. Can we talk about like how many episodes of Strange New Worlds is rogue groups of officers stealing things to do their own mission? Like, can they keep getting away with this?
Because
at some point, like, if they ran this by Pike, would Pike say no?
No, of course not.
So, like, why not just run it by the cat? Like, I'm getting a little, it seems like this ship is a little too slapdash. That, like, any collection of ensigns and second lieutenants can commandeer a spacecraft for whatever purpose they want. And it's like, it's kind of like, don't let Dad find out. But, like, I think Dad could find out, would be cool with it. So,
same thing happens in DS9 a lot. People
do they really
take runabouts to go do things without asking Sisko? And I'm like, why? He would give you permission. Because when they do ask him, he always does.
Yeah, because like the old series and Next Generation, can you imagine like Wesley and Geordi and I don't know, Deanna just commandeering a shuttle and doing something with like without Picard and Riker knowing? No fucking way would that fly.
Barclay and Ashley.
You can
Judd's
do shit on the holodeck without official permission, but taking a shuttle? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe ask the guy in charge. Yeah, so Spock is nervous. The dinner party's arriving. T'Pring beams aboard, and Spock escorts her to his quarters, where she's talking about how much her mother is annoying her and reminds Spock that everything has to go perfectly. I'm going to say her outfit, you know, she had a 3-hour debate about it with her mother. Pretty spectacular. This is a great outfit. I'm loving the, I think it's metallic shoulder pads and whatever's going on with her collar. That stuff is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she's always stunning.
And then T'Pring's mother arrives at the dinner, and this is where things get real tense. This whole time, Spock, you know, has been trying to act like a Vulcan with his pasted on ears. She asks what's wrong with Spock, and he says, "Oh, there's nerve damage. I singed my eyebrows." Yeah, they are looking a little funny.
See, all three Vulcans lean in to scrutinize his eyebrows and presumably ears. The way he comes back with, Captain Pike has worked all night on Vulcan delicacies. Just the way he did that line reading was so fucking funny.
Well, I love the eyebrows thing because it's always been a little bit weird, because what they did is they shave down Nimoy's the side of his eyebrows and put them into, you know, a V shape.
Right.
But you could always see that his eyebrows were shaved off there.
Yeah, he's got like 5 o'clock eyebrow shadow. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I feel like this is making fun of that.
Kinda, I think.
And I don't know if they do better makeup job now with Spock, where his eyebrows, you know, are covered over better. But in this episode, there was definitely a hint of the eyebrows.
They got some uncanny valley shit happening with his sideburns now. Like, oh man, those things are faded into like oblivion and then darkened back in. Every time I see his sideburns, it's weird.
Yeah, it's hipster Vulcan.
T'Pril's husband, I forget this guy's name. It starts with an S.
Yeah, I don't know his name.
I got it at some point, but yeah, he's just wharfing down this food. Like, you know, Pike has made this Vulcan delicacy and this traditional thing, and you can tell it's like really good even by Vulcan standards. But his mom, T'Pril, takes one look at it and it's like, oh, you can't hardly say this is traditional if it's done like this, and just shits
spirals
all over
it. Too tight, yeah.
And then her husband comes back with like, oh, now that I'm noticing, yes, this is entirely inappropriate. Oh, I was, you know,
Yeah, he does that a few times where he's just like totally reverses course in his opinion because she says something.
Yeah.
So she's like the contrarian, impossible to please. He's just like kind of go with the flow.
Plus, he's political.
I always wonder about
like
these matchups.
Because Amanda goes on the ship, Spock's mom, and like lays it all down. It's like, yeah, he is hungry. He is like trying to power through because he wants this relationship, because he wants the association with Sarek, who is this big swinging dick in Vulcan politics. And her mother hates humans. So like there's this tension between this guy obviously wants this relationship to work because he's ambitious, but he also is completely afraid of his wife. So anytime like he's trying to steer the needle between sticking this landing and also not making his home life complete hell. Any more than it already is, because this woman, oh my God.
Oh, she's too much, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It would be hard to live under the same roof, I feel like.
Yeah. This is a common thread in Star Trek 2 with mismatched marriages. I think of O'Brien and Keiko.
Oh my God.
Worf and Jadzia are like the prime example of that shit.
Is it that bad? Because I think O'Brien and Keiko are hard to beat. Like they just, it just seems like she hates him and he loves her, and she should just divorce him because he's just this big dumb transporter oaf. And
yeah, he loves her until he starts talking shit about her. Like it's hot and cold with him for sure.
Like, they, like, any time, like, if Data had to chase her down and convince her to marry, like, that should have been, I was off on this relationship from the very fucking beginning.
You know how many times they have had to convince Worf and Jadzia to get married? Every Nog has convinced them at this point. Every fucking character has had to go to them and say, no, you should definitely get married. I know you're completely incompatible.
Dude, I gotta finish my Deep Space Nine rewatch. I'm missing out.
It's a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Even when you don't agree with the character's decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Pike serves these hors d'oeuvres. They're judged pretty harshly by T'Pring's mother. She just wants the ritual to begin. She's just here to shit all over this marriage, find fault with Spock. And then Chapel, Ortegas, and Uhura go to the anomaly and decide to fly inside. We get a Jurassic Park line reference here. Hold on to your butts.
Is that Jurassic Park or?
Oh, that's Jurassic Park. I mean, Sam Jackson coined that phrase.
True. Never been uttered before. It was pinned in Jurassic Park.
Hold on to your butts. Why would she say hold on to your butts?
I mean, it's something you hold on to if you're a human going through a spatial anomaly. I did like Erica pointing out the absurdity of some of these Star Trek analogies when, you know, that someone will say, you know, it's like a stone skipping over a stream, or, you know, when they're talking about warp drive or something. And she's like, you know, I hate when you use these analogies because they never turn out right. She's like, what if it's like the ocean where it's like a tumultuous surface, but you go through it, it's nice and easy. It's like, why would a fucking interdimensional rift work anything like the ocean? Someone finally fucking said it, but then also said, you know, who am I? I'm Eric Ortegas. Am I going to be the person who says we shouldn't do the cool maneuver? So, they're really striking the right balance between self-awareness and classic Trek bullshit that I think, boy, it seems like you could go way too far in either direction, but they are just walking it perfect, I think.
I like what they did here. Very subtly by not doing something, because there's an opportunity here to point out some differences between some of these crew members going into this anomaly again, right? Uhura looks conspicuously different than the other two. They do not acknowledge that in any way whatsoever, which I think is both a smart move and commentary. I feel like they're saying it's one human race. This is not a difference that is a difference without a distinction is what it is.
Yeah, that's actually a good point, that when we're talking about Vulcans and Klingons, we're actually talking about people who are genetically distinct. They are a truly different species.
Yeah.
We're all Homo sapien here.
Mm-hmm. I think that was intentional commentary, but maybe not. Maybe they just didn't consider it.
It works.
I agree.
And it also, we haven't pointed this out, but like, them going through this rift is as lovely of an effect shot, like, as anything. You know, every time I see this, like, I think of what it would look like in The Next Generation, where you're like, well, I get it. It's supposed to be a subspace rift, but it looks like shit. This just all looks just like, yeah, that's exactly what a subspace rift would look like. And as the, like, shuttle kind of rolls through, it's just like there's constantly these flourishes and stuff they never could get with the models and never got with, like, especially the early days of, I don't know how you think about the early switch away from models to CG, but I always thought that, like, some of the earlier seasons of TNG looked better than some of the later seasons, even though you had so many more ships and stuff, but because they were models and the CG just wasn't quite there. And now it's just like everything just looks rock solid all the time.
Yeah, I just got to some big Dominion battles in DS9. Mm-hmm. And I will say by the time they get to the end of DS9, it's pretty solid.
They worked it out. Okay.
Yeah, but you're right. The stuff in TNG can be dodgy from time to time.
Yeah.
But this, I mean, this is, you know, modern visual effects stuff that looks amazing. Mm-hmm. This show, look, I'm not going to say it's foundation or anything in how good it looks, but it has its moments for sure.
Picard never looked this good. Like, Picard actually, you know, a lot of stuff, Picard looked like a cheaper show in a lot of ways. But this, they are sparing no expense. Or maybe they just didn't have one actor who was sucking up 90% of the budget. I don't know. But for whatever reason, the standard level of fit and finish on this show is better than, I don't know, Disco is beautiful too. I remember some of those first few seasons, some of the like battles and action shots were also jaw-droppingly gorgeous, but they got to dial in. They got to dial in for the show. And as an old science fiction fan, I will never not be amazed at how good things look nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely don't take it for granted yet, at least in this setting. So the ritual begins, and Spock serves tea. The thing that struck me about this is they've gone all this trouble prosthetically to make him look Vulcan.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have some kind of heat-resistant material they could coat his hands in? Make this a little easier on the poor guy?
That's a damn good question. Yeah. Yeah.
4th century science can't do anything about temperature differentials.
It gave him a really good, it's set up for his mom, the revelation that Spock makes about his mom, the fact that like how painful, how much she loves her family because of how much pain she's willing to endure at the hands of these Vulcans and her, you know, like this is essentially like you've seen all those kung fu movies where one of the last initiates, he has to carry a cauldron of coils. Coals are red hot and it like brands his arms as he moves it. Like that's essentially what they're doing here. And she just takes it like it's nothing because she's had so much practice.
Or Jean-Claude Van Damme having his crotch ripped.
Ripped open by his mystic
his
trainer.
Sensei.
I don't know. It worked out really well to have the theme of Spock appreciating his mother in a way that he never did before.
I agree. Yeah, this is a two-prong attack on the emotional side of Spock that I think works really well.
Yeah, and a couple other things, like I want to call out Captain Pike's green tunic that kind of harkens back to some of Kirk's alternate looks. I actually really like when Star Trek does this, where you get the idea that a Starfleet officer might have like an A-class uniform, B-class uniform, dress. You know, like it's not like you just see them lounge around in the same thing every day. And in particular, I forgot to call this out back during the episode where, you know, Uno was put on trial. But the dress uniforms on this show are some of the best I've ever seen in Star Trek. Like everything feels really well thought out and like a modern military's, you know, progression of like your battle dress uniform versus your work slops versus your actual dress uniform versus your class A's. Like there's a lot more continuity, and you know, where in TNG it's like everyone just wore the same thing and maybe you get a change up between seasons or maybe Picard would get a slightly fancier jacket. I like how everything, you know, like just like, yeah, again, the budget that they're spending on the outfits is so much better, and I like it.
Yeah, I agree.
Pike looks good in green.
Do you know there's talk of Kirk's typical uniform not actually being yellow? That it was green, in fact, and that the lighting was the thing that made it look yellow on screen?
That's weird. Maybe?
Yeah, I've heard that's a thing.
Because he actually had a green tunic that
he
like
did,
attached
yeah.
at the side. But they're saying the gold velour command uniform is actually green?
That's what I've heard. Yeah,
I mean,
it's tough to know 50 or 50, 60 now after the airing of it, because like stuff yellows and ages weird and
right.
decolors in a strange way with age.
Right. But I mean, there's been many cases where they've shown like because things didn't quite show up on the cameras. And then back like in the black and white era, it was wild. If you've ever seen like the garish colors they'd paint the set to get the exact right shade of gray. You've seen like the Munsters or Adams Family in like those sets in color, it's like psychedelic. So it would make sense, but no, I never heard that.
They were doing a lot of weird stuff with lighting on that show anyway, because like all the walls, you think of them as like being real colorful. They were slate gray. They were just straight gray, and they did all of that coloring with lighting.
They did a lot of like gel lights and like multicolor lights that kind of like, ooh, it's science fiction and everything. Yeah.
So I could see it being like a weird lighting thing.
Interplay.
Changing the color that.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's just a side note. Let's go to Chapel. Her crew finding themselves in interdimensional space, and they ask this alien, this Kirkovian blue, to fix their mistake. But it's a pretty unusual situation, and so Chapel asks to speak to Blue's manager, Yellow. She goes full
exactly.
Karen here.
That's what I had in my notes. She wanted to talk to the Blues manager. The complaint outside the response period, most irregular.
Yeah, what's the response period? Is that that initial contact?
I don't like. Yeah, it must be like you get 24 hours to complain about any alterations and then get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, it feels very like insurance policy,
it
like
does.
Like you said with a car wreck. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's go back over to the ritual. It continues with the airing of grievances. T'Pring's mother just tears Spock a new emotional asshole.
And his mom, too, disrespects his mom. Because Amanda's like, you know, T'Pring, I would like to see you visit more, and you should have more self-confidence. And his dad's, like, super supportive, and then her mom comes out, your human instincts are interfering with this improvement process. And the way she pointedly starts the clock, like, she is going to pack as much awareness into Spock's minute as she can, and Spock, like, trying not to have facial spasms. Is really good.
Yeah. And I kind of buy the, like, if you're all about divorcing yourself from the emotion of the criticism here, criticism can be an important part of improving yourself. I don't know if this criticism is particularly helpful.
Right.
But I guess in her, you know, Vulcan-addled mind, it makes sense to her.
No, you can see this being a beautiful, like, a part of a complete ceremony where, you know, you have this, like, you the male demonstrates that he has taken an interest in your family enough to master the subtle intricacies of your particular family's tea recipe and ritual, and both parents are able to share their concerns, their private concerns with their children and the ways they think they could do better. She's attacking things that fundamentally Spock can't change. Like, Spock's half human. And he's got a human mother. Fucking deal with it.
And you can't improve that, right?
Well, and the fact that, like, Spock and Sarek are kind of at a rift in this era in their relationship, and she goes in on that and is like, your father is correct to have shunned you. You have failed him as a son. You do not deserve our daughter. Like, fuck you, lady.
Yeah.
And Spock, fully human, does not... It withstands it. Withstands it.
At least long enough to excuse himself to the bathroom and scream into a towel.
Oh my god. I was laughing so hard because he's like, may I use the bathroom? And like, T'Pril is like, he should have a more resilient Vulcan bladder.
That's the best line in the episode.
That is just such a funny fucking line. And then Spock going to his quarters and punch dancing his emotions out and then screaming into a bath towel. It's so good. It's so good. It's just like, it reminds me of like Andy Samberg in Hot Rod, the movie, you know, him punch dancing his feelings out.
Nice. God, it's been ages since I've seen that.
Oh, by the way, yeah, if you think you listen to this podcast, like I think Aaron's humor is a lot like mine, and you haven't seen it, please watch Hot Rod, the movie starring Andy Samberg. It's so fucking funny, criminally underrated.
Yeah. This is before he got big with like Lonely Island and stuff, right?
But it's all the Lonely Island guys there. Uh-huh. You know, one of them starring and one of them's behind writing and directing. It's just, it's so good. So good.
So he then calls M'Benga to ask how the cure is going. And M'Benga tells Spock that Chapel went to the anomaly to ask for help because we got no idea what to do. And then we go over to Chapel, who tells the manager, I think you guys made a mistake. The receipt's wrong. Yellow tells her that Spock's only a friend, so she doesn't really have grounds to complain. And apparently, we find out that Spock chose to protect her in the crash by diverting the shields to her side of the shuttle. And so Chapel's forced here to confess and prodded by her friends. Like, seriously, Christine, come on. Confess her feelings for Spock to try to convince Yellow to put Spock back to normal.
It is wild because, like, you know, I think Chapel's trying to do the right thing. You know, she's got complicated feelings for Spock, not because her feelings are complicated, because the situation is complicated. And she's trying to pussyfoot around, and then when it just smash cuts to Ortegas and Uhura being like, oh my god, did you just say that you like Spock? It's funny to see these junior Starfleet officers essentially encouraging her to do the wrong thing. But it works within the what they're trying to do with this episode.
And I don't know. I'm really enjoying the tone of this. We've talked around it a little bit, but I really enjoy when they drop the Starfleet officer act.
Yeah.
And I know it's not an act, but that side of them, and they just talk like normal people.
Right.
They don't do it too often, and they don't do it too, like, extreme.
Yeah.
Because there are some characters in other shows that, like, they don't act or talk like Starfleet officers ever. Mm-hmm. But this, you know, they're talking with a friend. They're not on duty. This is something they all know and is obvious to everybody. Mm-hmm. And they just drop that formality of being a Starfleet officer and just say, come on, seriously?
Yeah. And I like Chapel saying that, like, the way you changed him is actually in line of what I kind of want. Like, he's easier to talk to. He's more, like, you know,
I can
figure out his emotions more easier. But he's also not the same guy, and it's not right. You got to change him back. It's not him.
Yeah, and that's right. I mean, she fell in love with Vulcan Spock, not human Spock.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go back to the ritual, which continues with the mind meld. And Pike jumps in and delays by interjecting the Earth tradition of charades. We don't get to see enough of charades. I wanted to see Vulcans actually playing charades, so I was a little let down by this.
Honestly, the father's misunderstanding of the rules of charades was almost funny enough. Where
ear,
yeah. Is that a sacred word?
Yeah.
It's so funny. And also, like, it's funny that the Vulcans, like, don't know enough about Earth culture to, like, I mean, what are you going to do? Call the captain a liar? The charades aren't an integral part of human bonding ritual? You know? And then him and
it, deeply insulting.
Especially since, like, he plays it like he came up with charades on the spot. Like, he's just trying to delay, and and Spock's mom's like, yes, that's right, there's still the human ritual of, and Pike's like, charades. And again, this man's comic timing is just impeccable, and it just makes the scene, this, if you give this to different actors, it just doesn't work, and it's like, I cringy and shit, but I'd ate it up.
Then Chapel shows up with a hypo full of cure for Spock. They excuse themselves, and Chapel asks why he moved the shields to her side, but before he can really confess anything, she turns him back into a Vulcan and leaves. I assume this would have, she doesn't feel right about kind of his exposed vulnerable state here and forcing him into admitting anything, I guess.
Well, especially since in the next room is his fiance. Like, this is all entirely inappropriate.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's...
For sure, even though I would say they seem like a better match than T'Pring ever did, but...
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
We'll have more to talk about.
They seem to care more about each other. I never really felt like... I never really understood why Spock cared about T'Pring. They don't ever see each other. Like, yeah, it never felt right. She's always criticizing him more than anything, and I feel like Chapel accepts Spock for who he is. I don't know. Anyway,
A lot of stuff I want to say is, like, contained in the scene, like, where they part. So it's like, I'll just wait. I'll wait to defend T'Pring that scene.
Yeah. So Spock mind melds with his mother, which concludes the dinner. And then now that he's, you know, Vulcan, he can do that. T'Pring's mother starts saying how she was impressed that he could perform the ritual being only half Vulcan. So Spock blows their minds by revealing that he was actually fully human when he performed that ritual. And then he tells his own mother how impressed he is by her.
Yeah. And here again, Pike in the background, where the T'Pring's dad wants more of that Vulcan shit now that everything's over with. And he's just like, I got you. And preparing to tray. And then Savette, that's his name. And then where the way he kind of veers off and alters course when he sees Spock just laying in to T'Pring's mom. It's really fun.
And the stuff he says to his own mom here, I mean, it's maybe not as poignant as the stuff that she says to him later in this episode, but it is of a piece, and it's very important. You know, he says...
Go ahead.
You refer to my human side as a handicap, yet here's my mother, the most resilient, compassionate, tolerant person I've ever known. one who's been judged by Vulcans her entire life, and yet she stands by, she stands for love, for family, for me. It's not a handicap, that's true strength. What he forgot to add, he should have said, and her bladder is beyond reproach. That would have just been the cherry on top.
This woman's never had to use the bathroom in an entire run of Star Trek. Okay.
Never seen it.
But really like it too. And it works on even better on rewatch, because like when I first watched this, I assumed when Spock says it's an ordinary day when she took me to school that he was bluffing because he didn't have his full Vulcan psychic abilities. But later in the episode, you find out that was what he saw, but it meant so much more. It was an ordinary day, but like he got a lot more out of it than he let on, but he didn't want to drag out all of his mother's humiliating, I guess, laundry, but he did it just enough to defend him against the Pring's mom. And I really like that. Like I said, it works. A lot of these episodes I've noticed work really well on a second watch. They set things up and pay off things that you'd kind of notice on that. And this is another one. Good job, Strange New Worlds.
Agreed. Firing on all cylinders this season so far, and we're halfway through, so... T'Pring is surprised that Spock couldn't tell her about being human. She doesn't think Spock trusts her, and she suggests that they take time apart.
T'Pring's 100% right, and I think like I was actually shocked to hear you say that you don't see why Spock is attracted to T'Pring, because I mean, just to get out of the way, she's super fucking hot.
Sure.
She's extremely attractive, and she has been so since the old series. She's always depicted as like this extremely beautiful Vulcan woman. She's also highly accomplished and driven, and she is like the one of the most desirable blue-blooded Vulcans of the planet Vulcan. And I think on a intellectual level, that's something that Spock aspires to be. Like Spock wants to be the statesman, the great Vulcan that his dad is, and having a woman like T'Pring on his arm would be a long way to solidifying that. And he genuinely admires her driven qualities. The fact that she, you saw that she's a humane, I guess she'd be a Vulcatarian, not humanitarian. You know, she does relief work, and, you know, she does a lot of like selfless giving of herself, which I think is why she admires Spock, even though it drives her crazy that Starfleet keeps him away from her. She's also trying to be long, you know, Vulcans have long lives. I can let him do his Starfleet career and we'll still have 200 years, 300 years to ourselves when he retires. And I think that they have shown that she's got a lot of forbearance and she's tried to make this thing work. And Spock was wrong to hide this from her. You know, it's a pretty flimsy excuse to say, well, you know, Vulcans aren't very good at lying or whatever, and I didn't want to put that stress on you. And she says, well, there's some logic to that, but also the emotion of it doesn't track. And it seems like she's legitimately brokenhearted by his inability to trust her with something that he trusts everyone on the Enterprise with.
Yeah, and I think that's what it comes down to, why I don't feel like they are a good match, because Spock isn't 100% Vulcan, right? He's also human. Spock is an anomaly within the Vulcan culture. Yes, for a Vulcan, maybe T'Pring is an amazing catch, but there's never felt like there's a connection there to me.
Yeah, but that's,
and
I think that's
the human side of him is much more in line with Chapel.
Yeah, and I think that's I like seeing this, because it depicts something that's common to love, the young love affairs, right? You know, that you get together and like you so admire this person, and but then, you know, you get certain to the relationship and it's just like, well, it's just not, you know, there's nothing wrong with that person. You don't have to talk yourself into hating them, but it's just like, it's just not exactly what you thought it would be, or they're not what you thought it'd be, or you both grow in not complementary ways where you want different things after a few years. And it's always sad. Sure. It's really sad when like no one's done anything wrong here. Although I think my scorecard, Spock did something wrong. I think.
Oh yeah. I'm with you.
I think he did something wrong. Sprinting to Nurse Chapel and immediately consummating a relationship. The fact that like he also made a mistake in not trusting her. It's not been the first time that he's done this elaborate quote unquote charades rather than be straight with her about a situation he's going under. And she doesn't even know the depth.
Caught him.
And she doesn't know exactly how much he's lied, because he has he has lied to her about his feelings about Nurse Chapel. Like, I could never, you know, and abused her trust in him to get away with some things that she wouldn't approve of. So it's like, yeah, Spock's kind of a little bit of a Vulcan fuckboy here, but like, I don't I don't hate T'Pring. And again, it shows me you got to get T'Pring, who I quite liked in season one, especially, to a place where she'd believably try to kill Spock and or his best friend in Vulcan ritual pond fire combat in the original series. And I feel like him doing the Ross Geller we're on a break bullshit is going to be it's probably going to get close. Us most of the way there.
Yep, I agree. Yeah, let's go to Chapel. She gets a call from this horrible Vulcan with the Fellowship, and he says that her application's been denied. She tells him, you know what, I did some serious archaeological medicine shit today. I don't need your stupid Fellowship, and in fact you don't deserve me. And that's the end of that.
I like how they played the Vulcan stick up his ass. Like, he was actually really hot to hear about this Kirkovian medicine. What research? And he's like, you know what? You can read my fucking paper. Click.
Like everybody else. Yeah.
So good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Put that in your Vulcan pipe and smoke it.
Yep. And then Pike commiserates with Spock over a glass of Talarian brandy. I don't know what he drinks.
I love it. A long last human ritual commiseration. Because what do you do? What do you say after that crazy experience?
I mean, sometimes bad shit happens and all you can do is experience it with somebody, you know?
You're a young Vulcan in love, man. You're going to have some scrapes and bruises and partial reversion to humans every once in a while.
Right. Yeah. Who amongst us hasn't reverted
hasn't gone through an energy rift and had half of her DNA replaced? Like, you know.
Honestly, on Star Trek, it's fewer than you'd think.
I watched Star Trek as a young person, and I appreciated that there's a lot. I appreciated, you know, it's kind of cringy as an adult, but seeing Geordi, like, being a complete loser at love and, like, figure that shit out, and seeing Wesley being, like, as an awkward young man myself, like, I felt like I learned a lot on how to relate to people from watching Star Trek. And sometimes having these, like, junior grade officers being a little bit arrested development and see them struggle, to the extent that I like to flatter myself that young people are still watching Star Trek, I kind of get, like, a good feeling about the young men and women that this show is raising, you know? That, they're modeling behaviors, both good and bad, and kind of showing that in real time, and people can, like, make decisions based on that. But because yeah, like I've always said, a lot of who I am today is because I watched a lot of Star Trek The Next Generation, and some of that was cringy adolescent type behavior that hell, my parents were gonna, you know, explain that stuff to me. My peers at school certainly weren't doing a good job, so
yeah, they had ideas, but
yeah,
none of them right. No, I think that's one of the things that Star Trek as a franchise has gotten pretty right in the last few years, especially with this, you know, Star Trek Strange New Worlds. I think they have, or maybe I'm attributing too much of a calculating nature to them, but in my mind, what's happened here is there are a lot of young people watching Star Trek now, in large part due to Discovery. And I think that's cool, as long as we can have the Star Trek Strange New Worlds that they can then look to for more Star Trek content that might guide them in directions that I view as almost gateways to the old Star Trek, you know, the stuff that I view as important, both, you know, in my development, but also in just like its general societal outlook. I think, yeah, you can hook people with the action and the crazy plots and the serialized stuff, and then maybe they'll be encouraged to come look at some of this other stuff that deals with more serious issues.
Sure.
So I don't know if that's been intentional by them to say, hey, let's hook them with Disco, the more action-based kind of thing, and then the movies, or if that's something they just kind of stumbled into, but I think it'll be effective.
It's a good question, because, like, again, this is the same crew that made all of the Star Trek that I didn't really like, and they're nailing this. So I don't know if it's the format, or if it's the cast they got, or just they've finally kind of got a handle on, or, you know, they told the other stories and now they're ready to go and kind of retread Star Trek. But whatever, I hope they keep it up, because it's it's entertaining, it's educational, it's enlightening, funny as hell, and it looks great.
We have a little bit more of this episode to cover. We get the scene where Spock asks his mother why she showed him that specific memory during their mind meld. She says it represented the first time she saw Spock being accepted by his people, and that it meant so much to her because of that.
And he's like, but you were not. You were shunned by those women. And he's like, but you were happy, and that's what mattered. And yeah, it's pretty moving.
Yeah, you realize how much she's sacrificed for Spock to grow up on Vulcan, to grow up among his own people, you know, because she could have taken him to Earth.
You can tell Spock never got those speeches of like, all the things I've sacrificed for you and your father. I came to this fucking desert planet where everybody thinks I stink and all these women look down their long green Vulcan noses at. No, she just provided a calm, stable, empathetic position in Spock's life, and realized that this is a decision I'm making and I'm owning it. It's a hard decision, but I'm doing what's right for my kid, and it's paid off beautifully because Spock's becoming a man she could be proud of.
Oh, my
God. I don't
know
how proud she'd be of what happens next, but you know, half Vulcans are allowed to not be perfect.
Before we get there, I want to throw up Alexander Mo. I don't know what his last name actually is. Alexander Rashenko, if you want to go with his
right
bullshit taken name. His grandparents' name, I think. Worf fucked him over big time.
Just
like Worf did the exact opposite, right? He took Alexander and sent him to his grandparents' house on Earth, mm-hmm. which turns out it's hard to be a Klingon on Earth.
Yes. Which Worf knows because he did the same thing.
Yeah.
He
and so he subjected his child knowingly to all of that just outcast nature. Like, he's giving him complexes and he knows it. Whereas Spock's mother did the hard thing, which was to give him the life that he would feel more comfortable with.
Yeah, does Alexander ever show up or is even referenced on Deep Space Nine?
Oh, yeah.
He does show up? Okay, because my memories of he just never shows up in Deep Space Nine. I'm like, oh my God, Worf just fucking deadbeat dads his own son. But
well, he does that for a long time. And then Alexander shows back up going, you deadbeat dadded me. What the
really
fuck?
Good. I don't remember that episode, but that needed to happen. Because he does do Alexander dirty.
Totally. Yeah, but, that's the counterexample.
Also, Worf never wanted to be a dad. His lover kind of did him dirty and concealing it for so it's like, all right, there's a lot of issues there. It's not all Worf's fault, but that's definitely an example of what not to do as a dad for sure.
Yeah, I feel like being a parent is in large part how much sacrifice are you willing to make for your child's well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And she's making a lot. And then finally, Spock tells Chapel that he and T'Pring are taking time apart and that he has feelings for her. And he's happy about that. He wants to feel them. And so they kiss because she feels the same. And more. They kiss and more, I think. They're falling out of frame at the end of this, making out. I assume falling right into a bed or against a bookshelf or something. I don't know.
I'm just going to do it right on the floor. Right against the bulkhead. It's going to be raw. Uncut, half human, half Vulcan, fully human
Vulcan
emotions.
Style.
Yeah.
Vulcans don't need a soft surface to bang. Are you kidding me? That's weakness. That's something humans do.
True. They like to fuck against red hot iron grates. That's what
Or rocks.
For them.
Pointy rocks on the surface.
Volcanic
of
rocks.
Mm-hmm.
That you pour boiling water over.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting in subsequent episodes.
I hope it's not insufferable. I really don't want to see Spock's personal log. I've been fucking the shit out of Merce Chapel. It got a little much. Remember the whole Spock at the Pring stuff and sees. Now she's on the ship.
Yeah.
Over and under, how many episodes are we going to see Chapel and Spock in bed?
Over under
for the rest of the season. We got five more episodes left.
2.5 over under.
I was going to say 3, and that's too many.
Yeah,
that's too many, man. That's too many. All right,
I'll allow 2.
I feel like Sulu in Star Trek VI. We got to turn into the wave. We got to turn into the wave of a horny Star Trek and ride it out, because it's not going to abate. It's not going to abate for sure.
No, I don't think so. Anyway, that's the end of the episode.
Shields up. Here come the ads.
Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character Furiosa, starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role and the mighty Thor Chris Hemsworth as the warlord Dr. Dementis. Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
At ease, Ensigns. Welcome back to Bald to Go.
Yeah, if you'd like to send us feedback on our show to Baldly Go, StarTrek@baldmove.com is where you want to send that feedback. Dominic says, I'm listening to the feedback for Strange New Worlds, and you're saying the brain can be starved of oxygen in 3 to 5 seconds with an MMA applied chokehold. I don't think that's a lack of oxygen, but the change in blood pressure in the brain. Why wouldn't holding your breath for 3 to 5 seconds have the same effect? Okay.
Well, because your brain's still getting oxygen with holding your breath. It's
exactly.
Just getting less and less and less and less. But when you choke off the blood, your brain gets zero oxygen.
There's and so all it's got is residual that's left inside, and it just burns through that in seconds. And that's the difference, because like when you're holding your breath, like you use a shockingly little of the oxygen you breathe in. When you breathe out, yes, you are exchanging carbon dioxide, but a ton of the oxygen is still in and just comes you just expel it right out. So when you hold your breath, there's a lot of oxygen that your body can keep absorbing. If you starve your brain of oxygen, either through a blood choke or a massive loss of blood pressure or an emptying of the blood of oxygen, like you would get if your lungs explosively decompressed and you had zero atmosphere, you would rapidly lose consciousness. That's why I'm
like
always
a burst blood vessel in your brain. That's why it kills
you
so fast, right?
Yeah. And I've always been skeptical of those stories of like, you know, people experimenting at the guillotine and trying to hold up a head and slap it and get its attention, because like you can't get a massive loss of blood pressure quite like decapitation. Like you go from, you know, what's 120 over 70 to 0 over 0. And like, I can't imagine you have more than seconds of consciousness in those type of search. So anyway, I could be wrong. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a doctor. These are just arguments I've heard from people who do have those qualifications. So holding your breath is not analogous to your brain being cut off from oxygen. But I hope that helps. Lucas says it's not a retcon that Kirk was lieutenant on the Farragut. We're talking about
Right.
Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. What, right? That was that episode?
I think they go
back in time. That's how it's supposed to be. The only Kirk we saw last season was a future alternate universe Kirk who was captain to Farragut because Pike didn't have his accident and stayed as captain of the Enterprise. That was the whole point of this episode. To avoid war, Kirk needs to be captain of the Enterprise for the balance of terror scenario with the Romulans. I'd suggest rewatching the first season finale. It's mostly a future alternate universe that only our Pike experienced. Every other character in the episode is from that future alternate universe. Jim didn't seem aware of this, though in a previous episode, Aaron had corrected him. It seems to have forgotten about it. I don't know.
That's the problem. I did rewatch that finale, and I forgot.
I did too.
I forgot the specifics of it.
Yeah. So, and that is the thing. It's like, it's always rough when we're coming in for second season when we just casually watch the first season because, surprise, surprise, watching episode two or three times, taking detailed notes, talking about that with my friend, and then considering feedback has a way of committing way more detail about episodes than just kind of watching it and being like, yeah, it's fucking cool, right?
And even then, anyway, I forget a lot.
Appreciate the correction, Luca. Ian says, oh, got a lot of Canadian feedback. Says, first, Ontario, I'm never sure when your pronunciation is a deliberate joke or just an Aaronism, but the tar in Ontario is more like tear, as in I tear up a paper, not tar as in a mammoth drowned in a tar pit. Well, bad news for Canadians. I boot that. I don't ever do these things as a joke, or hardly ever. It's just it just all gets fucked up, man. It's probably gonna be Ontario till I die, but I'll see if I can get an Ontario to remap my increasingly aging brain. Also, Ontario is geographically huge with a population of almost 15 million. It would be the fifth biggest U.S. state after California, Texas, Florida, and New York. Of course, Canada. Woo, how about that?
Ontario,
Canada, has far fewer people than the U.S. Ontario is not so much the equivalent of Ohio as Canadians' equivalent of most of the American East Coast and Midwest as well. Like you, I thought Paul Wesley was far more convincing as Kirk this time. I'm not quite the fully Shatner Kirk, but definitely in line with the also excellent Chris Pine Kirk. Agreed.
Yeah.
Gotta say that this Kirk's dying lines of "say hi to Sam for me" were far better than the canonical Kirk's dying lines of "oh my." I like "oh my."
I do too.
I like the idea of him starting the next big adventure and just, you know, of death and kind of being caught up in it like the explorer he is. But I know not everyone does. Pelia and La'an. We talked about whether Pelia has awareness of her and La'an's running into each other in the past. He says, I think we've already seen some of Pelia's reaction, and I assume she does remember the events. When La'an goes to the bridge in her 21st century clothes, Pelia is explaining her stolen artifacts to Pike, and Pelia definitely gives La'an a look. I think this is her saying, aha, now you're all caught up. But I hope there'll be more dialogue about this later. The ending. I thought it was interesting how untidy it was. Perhaps that says more about the Federation's utopia than Trek usually does. La'an has restored that utopia, but at immense personal cost. As you pointed out, in a way, the episode doesn't solve anything for her. She's possibly lonelier at the end than she was at the beginning, although she's found a different kind of acceptance of her background. I'm sure Trek makes a statement elsewhere, but I think it's a great example of how we can achieve that better world, and Trek has often been too cynical about it in recent years, but achieving it is also really, really hard work. Yeah, that's a good point, Ian, that we probably have within ourselves the ability to create a utopia, but it's going to require some joint individual sacrifices. I don't know, all of us can have $200 million yachts in a Star Trek utopia.
Well, but I don't know about you, but that's not much of a sacrifice for me.
True. But there's going to be the people that are making a sacrifice is going to be a big fucking sacrifice for them. And it might take us another 75, 80, 90, 100 years to get where everybody's ready to do that for the greater good. And hell, maybe we never get there. I don't know.
It's possible.
But Star Trek suggests we can if we're open to making life better for everyone, even if sometimes we get the short end of that straw. Michael says, you're right to be skeptical about Kirk's use of the Vulcan neck pinch. As evidence, I submit that in Star Trek 3, McCoy was busted because an intelligence officer heard him talk about travel to Genesis. With Spock's Katra, he has the skills and reflexes to go for the neck pinch, but his only effect on the victim was a raised eyebrow. Oh, it partially worked. Got the Vulcan eyebrow out of him, but... Mm-hmm. This is exactly what I thought. There was canonical examples of humans trying the neck pinch and it not working. Mm-hmm. Maybe McCoy was just too old and feeble, because he's pretty old at that point.
Yeah.
And like a healthy, strapping 26-year-old Lieutenant Kirk can do it. But I don't know.
Who knows?
Chris DC says, do you think a Star Trek temporal investigation department show would be any good? Each week they could go to a different time and fix things. They could even have a guest appearance by crews from other Star Trek shows. Or would it just be too complicated to keep all the canon straight? I think this is a hell of an idea for a series. It would work especially good as an animated series. Think about like Marvel's What If, where they have the Watcher, like Uatu, and he's going and seeing like, what if Captain America was Captain Britain? And what if... I think it'd be very cool.
I think I'd love to see them try it. I think it'd be hard to pull off in a particularly good way, because what do you do? Do you go back and start having adventures in like with the crews we know already? How do you do that? Like logistically with actors aging and stuff like that. Like
that's why
I
went
back to Enterprise era. When Scott Bakula is 80 years old.
Yeah, that's why I immediately went to animation, because you could smooth all that over. You could just draw Jonathan Frakes. You could draw William Shatner. You could get a person to ape their voice, or you could just AI voice it. But like, there's something about that format that lets them do like almost like Rod Sterling type of what is that they called that show? The Twilight Zone. Like you could do like weird, scary, you could do lighthearted, satirical, like, you know, you could just do push the Star Trek format even more. And I think the show would have to have a little bit of a tongue in cheek vibe, because you are playing with canonicity, but I
would have to have its own good characters in their own rights. I think like the cast that is part of the temporal investigation, you know, would have to be good, but if they nailed that, I think it could work really well.
Zach says, I do not have a long history with the old series besides the movies. I've been a bigger fan of later Star Treks, but I'm having a real problem with the eventual Kirk-Spock relationship. How can Spock just toss away Pike to make kissy faces with Kirk? I much prefer Pike to Kirk, but as I said, I don't have a big history with the old series.
Oh, man. You just pissed off a lot of people with that. Prefer Pike to Kirk. Woof.
I think canonically, and there's nothing in the Strange New Worlds that's convinced me otherwise, that Spock and Pike have a more father-son relationship, or at least mentor-mentee, big brother-little brother relationship, whereas Spock and Kirk became like brothers.
Yeah.
And that's the fundamental difference. Like, you can have a close relationship with your father, but you're never going to be as close as your father as you are your best friend, or like your adopted, you know, the person that you say you are my brother. And that's just like, yeah, if you watch all of Star Trek, you might come to appreciate that. But it's also one of those things where like, I could see them doing such a good job with this version of Spock and Kirk, or I'm sorry, Spock and Pike's relationship, that people, especially modern fans, might prefer it and not understand why Spock is so bestie with Kirk. But
yeah, I'm with you. I'm not like the world's biggest TOS fan. I've seen all the episodes, but maybe only once. I'm definitely like TNG DS9 era fan primarily, so I don't quite know. I mean I've seen all the original series movies, and I think those are good. I've seen some more than others. And so I get the vibe between Kirk and Spock. And like you said, it feels more fatherly. The Pike stuff feels more fatherly. I don't know. I think people, as we get further and further away from the original series, it becomes hokier and hokier. Yeah, I don't expect a lot of people will even know much about Kirk at all.
Yeah, and it's not just the special effects. It's just like even the performances are kind of old fashioned, uh-huh. and the you know, the social commentary they're doing back then is just so, like, you know, we take it for granted mm-hmm. nowadays. You know, like seeing Uhura and Kirk's kiss is like, who cares? Like, we have multiracial relationships all the time. It's like kind of almost the default mm-hmm. in modern productions. So like a lot of that's kind of lost, but like, yeah, I don't know. I was an old series fan. I'm old enough to be an old series fan before I was the Next Generation fan. In fact, I was excited about the Next Generation because I was a Star Trek fan and is excited to see new Star Trek. So I have a lot of affection for the original Holy Trilogy of Spock, Kirk, and McCoy. And yeah, like I said, I think the key difference is you've got like a more of a father-son, a paternal relationship, where he's taking a young Spock and like standing off his round corners and teaching him how to be a Starfleet officer, and Spock and Kirk are just, they're just BFFs.
Yeah.
All right, that'll do it for the feedback. Once again, that's StarTrek@baldmove.com. If you'd like to send us feedback, we'll be back next episode with another episode of Star Trek: Strange New Worlds. We'll see how much of the wave we have to turn into. We'll be back next week for another episode. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you then.